And if you guys want to move forward and in, you're welcome to. You're fine where you're at as well. But okay, I would like to open our final panel, which is a Q&A panel called Shaping Campus Life, How to Engage in Conversations with Peers. And I will be moderating this panel, which is a neat opportunity because I have been, I guess, in representing Love and Fidelity, I have been touched by the questions and the comments that have been made today. It's evident, your convictions are evident, the way that you think through through these questions and the way that you listen to the speakers shows great insight and wisdom and passion for these things. And our mission at the Love and Fidelity Network is to train, equip, and educate you with the arguments, resources, and direction you need to uphold the institution of marriage between a man and a woman, the unique role of the family, and the integrity of sex and human relationships. And so, in light of that, a lot of the questions that you have asked have been personal, and they've, I think, been answered quite well. And there's probably more answers to gain from that. When the Wilcoxes were speaking, there was a point that they made that I think applies well to perhaps this panel, in that they said, a man and a woman should find the unique talents that they have, bring those. So it didn't have to be 50-50, but it needed to be equitable. And I think in terms of the questions that you've asked, that there we could approach it the same way, that in our communities, we can bring the talents that we have and use them to make the proper arguments, to find the right direction and resources. And so as you think about questions that you have from the content today and about the differences between the sexes and the complementarity between them, I would just encourage you to think in terms of initiatives on your campus, to think about practical questions, messaging, like how you would phrase things or ask these speakers. They are scholars, and they do this sort of thing, and they respond to it both in the classroom and in the literature. And so ask them ways that you can respond in a newspaper column or in a conversation in a dorm. Ask them, you know, how to respond to opposition, both when it's posed to you as well as when you just you sense what it is in a broader way. And with that direction, we'll open it up for questions. I don't think we have a runner. Could we get that? Okay. You do. And I'm going to still listen. Wonderful.
All right, questions.
I guess I have a question of how you would suggest responding to professors. I'm an English major, and a number of my classes seem to evolve around reading text and seeing how the male characters are lacking and how the female characters would have been better off if they had never married. And I'm often the only one in the class who is arguing that the marriage is actually a good thing, and the point of the novel was to show the beauty of marriage. And my professors will also disagree with me, and kind of be like, no, you know, the institution of marriage, not so good, and these women were only adding in marriage because that's what they were forced to do because of the times they're living in. So how do you respond to a person of authority in cases like this without being too antagonizing?
Just quickly, I know sometimes it helps to give people research findings, right? There's the Heritage Foundation does familyfacts.org, and it's a great search site for details about why family structure matters, why marriage protects children and mothers and all of that. But I'll just say, I don't think that changes people. And that usually what what invites some kind of reflection or response is your own personal experience with the benefits of marriage, either in your parents or, and I don't even know what you necessarily draw on, except I think what changes people is being touched and reflecting on what they've seen in their own lives. And certainly there are painful marriages, no question, and people are hurt and damaged in some bad relationships. But our personal witnesses of the benefits of marriage can invite change. That's my experience.
The only thing I'd add, as a man who teaches in this area, I do find I defend the men a lot. I've got 3/4 to 4/5 women in my sex difference course. They really love this, but they've got all kinds of complaints about men. And I like to ask them these questions. First of all, I think the evidence is that lesbians couples get divorced more than homosexual couples. That's not a sign that women are that easy to get along with. Now, you want another sign? Who argues more with their roommates in college? The girls or the boys? Isn't it the girls? They're always having some debate, some argument with their roommate about this and that. The boys, it's fine. They don't have them. Who has more arguments? Mothers and daughters-in-law? Or fathers and son-in-laws? I think it's pretty clear it's mothers and daughters-in-law. So if women are that easy to get along with, why is it when you put two of them together, they have a hard time getting along with each other? So I think, in a way, it's a sign of complementarity maybe being helpful. In other words, women have these high standards for relationships of every kind, and they're always checking them out to see how they're doing. Guys are, fine, you know. And maybe it's a good idea to have one guy like that in the relationship, because if there's two people who are always thinking about how's it going, who's doing this, it may just be more intensity than we can take.
That's right. Lower standards, higher averages.
That's right.
That's right.
So at least maybe inviting those kind of questions, making points that way. I know it's hard. You feel like you're arguing with everyone, and that's...
One of the things that I struggle with is I have a group of friends who they've more bought into the culture of people not in this room, the hookup culture, and talking to them about like my own personal views and hearing about the stories that they have is hard sometimes because I don't want to say something that sounds judgmental, but I also want the best for them and like... I was wondering what you guys think about how to approach conversations among peers without seeming judgmental or as if we're up on a pedestal.
Well, I mean, I think almost everybody eventually wants to get married, including these people who are hooking up, and I guess... You could ask, you know, is this seem like a particularly good way of getting to know one special person? You know, it's not a bad idea to have a boyfriend or two or along the way and some serious dating just to see what that's like. And hooking up isn't really helpful in this regard. So it doesn't seem, even if you're not someone who wants to maybe chase till marriage, it doesn't seem like it would be a helpful way to help you kind of sort through what men are like and what kind of characteristics I'm looking for.
I would just think from the way you asked the question that you probably don't have that much to worry about because, you know, because there, you know, sincerity matters a lot. And, you know, they say people don't care what you know until they know that you care. So if you... or communicating genuine, you know, human sympathy for a fellow human being who is a friend of yours, it seems like that goes a long way. And so people don't like to be lectured either, you know, that kind of lecturing, finger-pointing style. So we don't do that. And we don't divide the world into the people who have the correct answers and the people who have the incorrect answers. People hate that. I hate that. Everybody hates that. But if you could, to me, not that I've always been successful at it, but if you can just avoid some of those pitfalls, which are actually pitfalls of hubris and pride, then, you know, you're okay because you're relating to, you know, as, you know, and you do have something to say. And it seems like it could be said in a good way. I know it's easier said than done. And I certainly, we probably all three been in plenty of situations where you get accused of these bad ways of communicating, but certainly important not to just be silent and intimidated by the surrounding world. You know, that's another problem when you do that.
I really like, sorry to add too, I appreciate what was shared. I was thinking certainly sincerity is the key. And I think sometimes what we might fail to recognize is how much they are like us. I think that's what you're seeing. These friends want intimacy. They want connection. They want marriage. Eventually they want children. We want the same things. And I think just compassionately recognizing this is what you want and I want too. And that the way that I feel like I can have that is to pursue a life this way. And I think what's interesting with the hookup culture is there's been some research showing that people think there's more hooking up than there actually is. I know that probably surprises you, but they think everybody out there is hooking up. Everybody's doing a one-night stand. Everybody's meeting in bars. And there's a lot of people who are not. But because of that influence of cultural paradigm, pluralistic ignorance, we'll call it, then we'll think, I'm the only one who's not doing that. And I think even just asking that question to inviting, there's so many other ways to live and that we all want to have this kind of happiness in our lives.
I would just add to kind of bring these together as well. I think one of the things that the greatest teachers I know do is that they ask questions. They invite you to think. And that opens up someone's both mind and heart. They start to really consider, especially when you ask them in a way that invites them to answer however they really do feel, as opposed to, you know, saying what the answer will be. Before I worked at the network, I looked to resources. I looked both at the Love and Fidelity Network and, as I mentioned to David earlier, the Institute for American Values. I liked their tone. And so look to resources. Those may be different for you, but look to someone who speaks and writes in a way that you would like to. And then write. As you write, as these scholars have done prolifically, you will find that you have a voice, you know, and that you'll become even more committed to that voice and more comfortable with it and able to then engage your peers.
That's a good point.
Other questions?
This is a bit of an unusual question, but we, in taking our message to the world of our campuses, are often called hypocrites. But I'm specifically asking, what do you do? How do you promote the sanctity of marriage and the upholding families, like what we've discussed today, when the person you're talking to about it knows for a fact that you have not always acted in the best way to do that? And, you know, how can you still advocate if you have done yourself what we have not endorsed?
Well, to put it in religious terms, it may ring true to some of you. Ain't nobody here but us sinners. You know, really, seriously. Ain't nobody, there's no, so that's one of the things that is so, I think if you look at how a lot of the public debate in the country gets expressed now, that sanctimonious attitude about I happen to be one of the good people. I have it all worked out. I'm a model. And I have my wife here who's another model. And we love each other oh so much. We're perfect in pretty much every way. And we're just blessed. We're just so blessed. And if only others could know the truth that we know about how everything should be organized. I mean, it just makes your skin crawl, right? First of all, it's not true. It's just completely not true. And everybody knows it's not true. So, but I don't know. I don't get the feeling that that would be a problem for you all. Or, you know, I don't get the feeling from the way you're talking that that's the way you talk to other people. So, I mean, when anybody said that to me, I've always just tried to say as honestly as I can, well, gee, you know, if you're trying to tell me that, you know, I shouldn't put myself up as being a better person than you are, then I agree. I'm not. I mean, you don't have to, that's not the question is who are the good people and who are the bad people. And the question is not who are the smart people and who are the dumb people. It's just not the issue. That's not what we're having a debate about.
So. I would just add to that, I think anyone who has an opinion about anything, which is everyone, fails at some point to live up to whatever it is that they hold to be true or mostly true or, you know, whatever. So whether it's something about marriage or any of the other, you know, hot topics or something that every culture has always you know, profess to be good for society, like not stealing or lying. Everybody's failed to be honest all the time, but we still know that it's good to be honest, right. And that you can never judge a good by people's failure to live up to it. Maybe you can start to judge it by those who have. So in like a religious context, you can't judge a religion by those who, you know, fail to live up to, who aren't charitable or any of these things, but you can look at the, you know, those who really have, the saints, et cetera. If you want to start to look at specific examples, that's what you can do. But, yeah, those are my two cents.
Yeah.
And we're inviting a culture of change, right? So wouldn't it be natural that, you know, some of us have changed, all of us have changed, really, but that some more drastically than others, you know, and we're living in accordance with that, right? So it's a good thing to remember. It's also good to remember, I think, in this, that you have a spectrum which you're operating on, and I think, you know, as we talk about it at the network, it's important that we are speaking to people who are fence sitters and that they just need to know that everything that's been shown today and that is being spoken of right now exists, and that it, you know, bears light to what they already want to live. And so we're not trying to find the people who are our biggest naysayers and change, you know, them as much as the people that...
Seekers. Yeah.
Okay, this is a question mainly directed at Mr. David Hinkenhorn. And as you mentioned, you were an expert witness in the California case, and you also said that you personally felt like the gay marriage issue was over and we lost that issue. And I wonder why you think that we have lost. I've kind of had those feelings too. I'm a government major, and a lot of times when this comes up in policy classes, It's really hard to debate it with other people, because it often just turns into like a civil liberties argument, pretty much. And right. They have a lot better buzzwords for their cause than we do, I feel like. And I just want to know more about your personal experience in that, and why you think legal options in the country are not working or won't work in the future.
Well. From the beginning, the issue has been largely framed in the public mind as an issue of civil rights. And civil rights is a vocabulary and a category that's going to trump, in this freedom-loving country of ours, it's going to trump other rights. So if the issue is one of civil rights, then that's pretty much the game's over. I thought a few years ago that it was worth making an argument to say that what if the question was, what is marriage and do we value marriage? And I think that argument has been made and lost at the on the issue of this policy change for two reasons. One is that the decision-making people in society at every level have almost unanimously and passionately decided that we must have gay marriage. You would need a search warrant to find one who doesn't believe that. Secondly, those people who do not believe we should have gay marriage will not say so. I never should have been a witness at the Prop 8 trial. There should have been 50, 60, 150 people from Ivy League, tenured professors from Ivy League schools who all they would have had to do was say what they actually think about what is the state of evidence today. You know how many of them volunteered to do that? Zero. We have 300 million people, zero would testify. Why? Why wouldn't they go to the courtroom and be sworn in and say what they believe to be true about their own research? Answer, they didn't want to pay the personal price that would have been exacted against them in terms of just a very rough time. So they didn't. When the elites of a society have all decided that they're either in favor of something or they're not willing to say anything against it, it's over. Therefore, it's over. Therefore, end of discussion. And that's kind of what I think. Now, there are people who have a different point of view about this, including some very smart people who have been friends and colleagues of mine for years. So I don't want you to take what I say as the gospel on this. I could be wrong, you know, but in my own work, what I'm trying to do is think about how to be a person who tries to do something for marriage in a kind of post-gay marriage debate environment. It's not because I want that to be the environment, but because it just simply is the environment, I think. But there are people who believe differently, and you may be one of them. I'm really not saying I'm right. No one knows the future. No one knows the future. There could be all kinds of things happening. But I was just sharing with you my own thought about it, really.
So I don't think it's over. And one of the reasons is, well, you look at state struggles over this. So like what just happened in Maryland, how would you respond to that? So it was dropped from the legislature in Maryland, you know, because there was a lot of reaction once the word got out that this is a gay marriage bill. At least that's my impression. I don't live in Maryland, but the word got out and people rallied around this. We don't want this, and talked to their legislators. And that, along with lots of other indications, gives me a sense that there are people who care about preserving marriage for the sake of children to have access to their parents, their mother and father. So I don't think it's over. And I think if you want encouragement about that, go to the NOM website. He knows them all very well. Maggie's a great friend of yours, and Maggie doesn't think it's over.
If Maggie were here now, it would be a fist going right into my jaw.
Yes, she would be horrified that he said that. Right, in a sense. And so I think it's important to keep courage about this. But he is a warrior who's fought for a long time, and so we're gonna have a fresher view than he will have, I'm gonna say.
I'm being sent out to pasture now.
No, we build on great shoulders is how it is, okay?
Oh,
we're not letting you go out to pasture, but I'm just going to bring in, we need a fresh view about this, okay? So go to the NOM website, National Organization for Marriage. You'll get Brian Brown's updates, and you see good things happen with people responding to that issue and wanting to preserve marriage.
All right. I'm glad you said that, because that is the other,
there we go. There's the other
there
side.
It is.
I might add here, too, there is recently to the point of NOM, there's a recent hire there who is working with students specifically to help them write about the issues. So I can put you in touch with him if you'd like.
I don't want to disagree. I mean, obviously we're putting out two different points of view, but I respect that. And I, what you said is very powerful. I only want to say, as I wander off to pasture and chewing my cud, I just want to say that I am not embracing, I'm not advocating passivity, giving up, doing nothing. I'm just trying to think of what is the thing to do. So it's not a question of quitting or giving up your principles or anything like that. But I hear what you're saying, and it's a good point.
Thank you. Okay, so I had an interesting situation at the beginning of the semester. I saw what was being offered on our courses, the marriage class, of course, that perked up my ears because that seemed very intriguing. I didn't realize it was in women's studies when I signed up for it. That does have an effect, I found out. But it would have been...
Was the gay marriage class?
Polyamorous
relationship. We touched on that quite a bit. It was more the... I don't see the point of marriage class. It was the anti-marriage class is what I fondly started to call it. It was only 5 weeks long. It was more of a test case. A senior was doing research for a thesis project looking at marriage education in higher education. So it wasn't directly just the marriage class. It was more researching different methods of marriage education and what qualified as marriage education. And it took us 2 weeks to even start asking the question of what is marriage. So it wasn't a very well-led class. But what I came out of it wondering, because I was kind of the black sheep in the crowd. I was someone who actually had parents who were still together after 36 years. My grandparents had been together until the day they died, you know, and I was pro-marriage out of like three people who were pro-marriage in a class of about 13 people. What I was met with was actually, like, my professor, for instance, has been in a committed relationship for, I think, 13 years, has two sons, and in my mind, for all intents and purposes, was married, but was not married. And she did not see the point of marriage at all. And my question kind of kept coming back to her of, if you're living in a married state, what is essentially a married state without having gotten up to make vows, but you're in a committed relationship, why aren't you married? And she couldn't really answer that. It was more like, well, I didn't want to give up this, or... came down to a lot of selfish reasons. But I was wondering how you might be able to react and at least present a positive influence to someone who has been living in a married state for the most part, in the fact that they are together, they're committed, they have children, and they're raising them together, but does not see the point of marriage. And I could not bring in a religious argument, love, though I would have brought that in, because she's not religious. And to me, that was the missing link. But do you have any advice as to how to at least present why marriage might even be a good option for her?
Well, just quickly, and then I know maybe my other panelists will want to say something. I don't think I would say that they were living in a married state. They were not. There's living together and there's being married, and those are not the same. And, pardon? Well, just descriptively, what happens when you get married is that you make a public, legally binding vow that is shared with your community. It's public, not private. It has a legal and social dimension. You're not just making a private decision with your lover to live together or to have sex together or to bear a child together. You're making a communal, social, legal, public, formal commitment to one another that has religious and legal consequences. And therefore, it is different. If it weren't different, then there would be no need to have marriage. Well, I think that probably...
Nurtured, healthy, so to speak,
if people want to live together, they can. And there's nothing, I mean, I think there's something wrong with it if you have children, but, you know, it's a free country. But some people, maybe not your professor of marriage, but some people believe that the that the institutional quality of marriage that has to do with its communal and legal and public dimensions that are different from the purely private decision-making of the two lovers, they believe that those are actual differences. And lo and behold, the scholarship, which could have been reviewed by your professor of marriage, suggests that those differences actually play themselves out in fairly significant ways in every domain of life. And I have a friend who used to be a columnist at one of the big newspapers, and he said, well, he said, you know, if my daughter came to me and said, would you lend money to my boyfriend? Or she came to me and said, would you lend money to my husband? Those are two different questions. And so I've spoken too much. I just think that the social and legal and public dimensions of marriage are what make it marriage. It's what distinguishes from a private love relationship. And if you don't want to do, I mean, you know what I mean. You can have a different idea, but I think the evidence is complete, just overwhelming that couples who participate in this public thing think about it differently and have different outcomes. Their children, things happen differently for their children. And so it may not be true in the case of your professor of marriage who thinks that living together, you know what I mean? But it really is that way.
And so you can hold to that, just hold to that, because it's true. I mean, talking about what marriage does for the larger culture, why it needs to be a public thing, and because you're right.
Community that you know, that is attesting that even these two people ought to be together, and that, you know, they are who they say they are. Even just, I mean, most marriages you have to ask that of the community who's there, the witness. But I found myself almost hitting a roadblock with someone who was like way past that step, mm-hmm. to the point that, well, I'm happily together, we'll always be together, even though there's just knowledge, I guess, that you'll always be together, even though there isn't a vow there. It was just kind of hard to meet in the sense that she was way past that already. The kids were doing fine, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know how to meet it.
Yeah. So I think that might be one of those times where you just decide who your audience is, you know, and if you have done what these speakers have suggested, then... you see it as something you learned from. You have a great opportunity to grow in your ability to speak about it, and you move on to speaking to someone who may be convinced. You know,
I mean, the analogy, wouldn't there be kind of an analogy for, you said, a couple of dentists who decided to set up a dental practice, and in one case, they just went into a building and set up some dental chairs, and if anybody wandered in. Or maybe they practice dentistry on one another, or, you know, maybe they, but they put no sign up. They didn't call themselves dentists, and they didn't incorporate as a dental practice. They were just kind of a couple of guys with a couple of chairs and a room. And they might be really good dentists, and they might be really devoted to the cause of dentistry, but it really is different if there's a sign in the door that says, this is a dentist. And it's a dental practice that has the formal setup is incorporated into. There's all kind of analogies I think you could come up with between private activity that has no bearing on public and social questions versus a public activity that is publicly recognized and in which there is a state interest. I don't think it's too hard to grasp the difference between those two kinds of activities. Anyway.
Other questions?
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I had a question kind of similar to hers, where I found myself in a conversation with strangers online in like comment thread boxes on the issue of same-sex marriage. And one of the criticisms that was posed to me was, it's actually none of your business or none of any individual person's business what the state of marriage becomes. This sort of disconnect that marriage has become really a personal matter, and then there's a rift to the legislative element or arena, and there's kind of no in-between where the people that make up the state have the right to participate in that conversation. And so how would you suggest responding to that beyond the point that, well, we participate in the state and it is there for our good as well, so therefore it we do have some vested interest in what becomes of that legislation?
I think David will have a lot of thoughts in response to that. One of the things I think to be clear about is that it really is about the definition of marriage. This question really is about what marriage is. And it's not about legislating how people live per se, meaning how people, whether or not they choose to cohabit as lesbians or gays or what or whatever, but it's about defining what marriage is, and that the state has tremendous interest in that, just as you've said, because of all the goods that we depend on that come from it, not the least of which is our future children. And that is the critical piece there. And so I think when we can keep it in the, even though you feel like we've gone beyond that, but when we can keep it in the question of what marriage is and protecting the definition of marriage because of the goods that we depend on for it, because of what it does for children, because of its essential nature, then we don't have to worry about, we're not talking about legislating what people are doing in terms of their, in terms of the way they live their lives.
Yeah.
The simplest way I've said it, tried to say it in the simplest way, is if you change the definition of an institution, you change that institution for everyone who participates in it. Everyone.
Yes.
Not just gay people, lesbian people, straight people. You change it for everyone who participates in it. So therefore, everyone who participates in it has a right to have a point of view about that. However, I'll just tell you that having said that in one way or another about 700,000 times, it is overwhelmingly believed out there that why on earth would you have any, you know, would you have any reason to care one way or another about how other people do this? So we haven't made much progress in making this argument, but I think it's the only argument that can be made.
Dr. Rhodes, would you mind maybe tying that to today's discussion of gender, as well as just your suggestions regarding policy and that kind of thing?
Policy on same-sex marriage?
No, just you deal with policy a lot.
Well, I think on same-sex marriage, I think one can make a case that men and women really are different. And if you focus on children, it's, if I'm right, and David Paquette's got a terrific article on this, and citing some people who say, you know, it's because a lot of people, I think, especially women, think there's too much competition in the world, there's too much aggression, and they kind of think, even though they're not radicals, why can't my husband be more like me? And if you can show them that, in fact, that's a less successful parenting combination than if he's like the way he is. That just as I said today, you need on the one hand the enveloping love, come to me with the skinned knee, and also something that's a little tougher and reminds people in the outside world, not everybody's going to love you or nobody to run to. You're going to have to learn to do some of these things on your own. And if since there's evidence...
Make your own sandwiches.
Right. since there's evidence that that combination isn't just as good but better for kids, that they get along better with their peers when they have both those things in their life, then I think it's hard to see how two women or two men can give you that complementarity.
I think we have time for one or two more questions, depending.
Okay.
Is it helpful in the conversations that you've maybe had, you were saying that it's not very effective to say that it affects all of us that are involved in the institution of marriage. Is it helpful to approach it from like a child's rights perspective where you say, you know, a child has a right to a mother and a father? I don't know. Is that compelling to people? I don't know.
It should be.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that you bring that up. I really thought that was going to be such a powerful argument. I still think it just has everything going for it. I mean, for goodness gracious, it's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. This is something that is fundamental. So I'm with you. It's there. But it has not made any headway in the public argument as far as I can see.
I would just echo that I think it is a compelling argument. And Brad Wilcox actually has an interesting piece on this in the context of artificial insemination, because we're getting to the point where there's now people 18, 20 years old, and they're beginning to speak for themselves and say, who decided I didn't need a father?
Right.
Or sperm donations and so on, desperately trying to find their father. Who decided I don't need to know my father? You know, they're obviously very, very hurt about this, to kind of collect those people and their testimony and present it somewhere, I think would be rhetorically very effective. But obviously it has something to do with the same-sex marriage debate, because you're again talking about people deciding that I didn't need a father.
Problem is that when you argue for the rights of children, those rights are in some degree in tension with other alleged rights. And the fundamental right, in contrast to this right of the child, is the right of adults to form families in any way they choose. That is alleged as to be a right. And in our very... in our society today, that right of the adults to do whatever they want to do, whenever they want to do it, for whatever reason they want to do it for, trumps the right of the child to know her parents.
I think in personal conversations where people might disagree on this issue, I think that one does get some people. What about your own personal feelings as a child?
Yeah.
What would you want to have? You'd want to have your mother and a father. And I think in this same-sex marriage debate, one of the things that you know the research is really underdeveloped on that side, and one of the ways it's underdeveloped is what we're getting from in vitro, you know, sperm bank findings, is that when people want to form their own families, that's when all these issues come up, right? I don't know who I'm passing on a heritage to, because I don't know my own heritage, and we're not seeing the effects as obviously until it's time for them to form their own families. That's why the longer people delay marriage, in a sense, the more we have this group who's disconnected from children and the rights of children. And they would be more inclined to say, it's about me and my rights, than as a parent they would feel for they would want for their children to have.
I might pose one more question off of Catherine's, in that emerging adulthood is you know, studied and coined as this term for 18 to 25-year-olds who... Erickson's theory of generativity is sort of that ultimately in development that you will want to give back to society and to give to children. This extended adolescence isn't a time when that develops, and so in my own studies I've wanted to show, I guess, that there are some emerging adults that have these generative feelings. And the scholar of emerging adulthood told me no, like it's not possible. And so I wonder what differentiated the generation, you know, or to be previous to ours then. Because if it's a part of human development that you just don't think about the children of the next generation in this age group, why did people used to think about it, you know? And what can society, like, how can society teach 18 to 20 year olds, you know, that children matter, and what is the argument for it? why do children matter in response to David's, you know, comment about why do children matter above the rights of parents? How is that good?
Well, I think whoever told you that this Erikson's concept of generativity could never be applicable to people in their early 20s is just mistaken. I mean, let's start with that. That is a wrong idea, just empirically and just about every imaginable way, because our own history and the history of almost every human group shows that that's not true. Why we have evolved this new period of life in the 20s, I have to say I don't feel qualified to say. Why? I think it has some advantages and some considerable disadvantages, but I don't know where it comes from.
But more, how do we respond to do children matter?
I just have a quick comment. I'm LDS Mormon, and there's been a recent talk about women in who are in their mid-30s and not married and who are not religious, who are kind of addicted to these Mormon mommy blogs. And they like to get on and see how Mormon mothers are living. And when they talk about it, when they talked about it on the Today Show, it was this comment of, you just don't even believe that's a possibility, like that people can be in these happy marriages and that husbands are kind to their wives and that mothers like being home and caring for their children and they like making cookies, that kind of thing, whatever. And I think one of the things is you give a vision to your friends about the happiness that can be and that it's possible to have that. It's possible to have committed relationships and that you're kind of a witness of this being a good thing and that children will bring meaning, as Brad Wilcox talked about earlier today, that transcends any kind of meaning.
That's great. Other questions?
So as a young woman in an engineering field, I oftentimes have conflicting visions of the future because I'm being trained in pretty much one general skill set. So you go and you are an engineer. That's kind of the career that I see for myself. But then I also don't want to rule out the possibility of motherhood. So I was wondering what kind of advice you could give for young women in a similar situation who really love what they do but also don't want to and really want to excel at that and find meaning in it, but don't want to rule out the possibility of family life. How do we think through those things and talk about them with peers, because our peers are mainly, at least at our engineering school, are mainly male. Yeah. And so they kind of don't have those problems to think about when they're trying to think about where they're going to intern or what they're going to do.
Yeah, right. You can, yeah.
Oh, that's a tough one, mainly because I don't know much about engineering, what the options might be. I do have a sister-in-law who's a scientist, kind of a hard scientist. She has great fun teaching. Even just teaching science to girls, she's got this experiment where she shoots a Barbie doll into a garbage can. the girls love it. but I just don't know whether this is a profession that where there's part-time work or not. And I think you ought to look into that right away and maybe channel your if it interests you at all, channel some of your effort into that kind of engineering. I just don't know enough about that particular. I do think, in general, it's harder in business where people are transferred around a lot and where there's less flexibility. Although I do think that if women are good and they've been there a while and then have a baby, they'll find a way to make accommodations for you because they don't want to lose you.
I guess I just have two maybe additional thoughts. One is, I think it's great to keep that motherhood role at the forefront of your mind and that is what you're preparing to be and that your education and your training, your opportunities will only strengthen your ability to mother and to educate your own children and to be an influence for good in their lives and in the community. And so just setting that aside, though, there are, I'm amazed at how innovative women are in terms of finding niches that are meaningful in terms of contributing professionally and being able to nurture and care for their children the way that they want to. And so I think as you keep that in your mind, you will find remarkable ways to do that. And you might find that your interests professionally change. So we were just talking at lunch about the ways that women contribute. Sometimes they'll come out of the workforce and stay home primarily with their children for a period of time. And they'll come back and they'll have very different interests than they thought when they were in college. And they're doing all kinds of uniquely contributing things that are so important in building communities. May not make tons of money, but they're really important in building communities, and they find tremendous meaning in that type of work. So does that help at all? It is hard. That whole work and family issue is very hard. I think don't be afraid to keep in the primal part of your brain, I am preparing, most importantly, to be a mother. And I think taking cooking classes, I think the things that you do to strengthen your ability to actually care for and nurture life are really important. And that you don't have to see them. I don't see them as actually equal. I don't see myself as a professional and a mother. I think I am a mother, and I also have some professional interests that I pursue, and I do, and I enjoy them. But this child depends on me to be their mother.
This is just a little tangent, really. I can't add anything to what has been said, really. It's just that when I, you know, I have a 21-year-old son who's thinking about graduate school and so on, and I don't know. It seems like there's a great deal of focus and intensity among young college graduates today about their career, and just so much, I don't know. I mean, another perspective is that life is pretty long. And you can do a lot of things. And the idea that if you, like, stop doing one thing for 6 months, that you're going to be forever lost in the big race of your profession. You know, I mean, all I'm really saying is that what I notice, and this could just be the more competitive environment that you're entering into, and the I don't know what all the reasons are, but I see a lot of worry that somehow, if I am not full out every day without missing a day, without missing an hour, you know, but the idea that I would do something else for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years seems harder for people today. Maybe it should. Maybe that's just the reality. Maybe in engineering, that's absolutely the reality. But I'm just observing that it seems particularly acute in people of your age entering into professional training. And I just sometimes I ask myself, is it really true that you won't be happy if you just take some, like, think of life in a more sequencing way? I don't know. It's just a question.
I think you can have it all in that sense, but you have it all at different times. Yeah. The seasons approach is so beautiful. I think that's a great answer to see life in seasons. I don't know if that answers your question, though. Thoughts, I guess. Right. Go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering if I could. I was just thinking about this topic of professions, and a question had come up earlier about my wife was asked about a large family, and I think they're often tied together. This feelings of how do I have family, and how do I have my profession, and how do they work out, and I was just reminded of something that my wife's father shared at a wedding breakfast for his 11th child. His last daughter, Janet's sister, was just married, and he was looking out at his family, and he was looking at his 11th child, and he was thinking about all of them, and he said, "Our family, I couldn't imagine my family without any one of them. It had been a sacrifice during many times for the family that they had had, and to give life to so many and to provide for so many, but it wasn't a sacrifice in the end, and they were so grateful for all that they had. And I think we often we're taught so much as was mentioned earlier to focus on our educations and our professions, and we've lost some of thinking about our families and planning for our families and having a very careful and deliberate plan that our professions serve our families. As fathers, my greatest role now is to be able to provide for my family, not to distinguish myself in some way professionally, but to be able to be, as my wife talked about, a provider that enables her, that endows her to care for our little daughter. And I'm grateful for that role, and to think of that position as enabling family.
That was a great closing remark to kind of bring it all together. Let's thank our panelists and speakers one more time.
Thank you all.
Carry on. You have lots of good work to do.
Okay, now Dr. Stephen Rhodes will provide our closing remarks.
I've been asked to say a little bit more, and you've heard an awful lot, so I won't take too much time. But my old opposite, Janet Hyde, when she complains about people talk about sex differences, she says one of the biggest problems is it creates conflict between men and women. He's from Mars, you're from Venus. How in the world are you ever going to talk to each other? And I'm convinced it doesn't, that it helps for better understanding. I'm going to give you a couple examples. I had a graduate student in my class, and I went over the fact that men often don't look at people when they talk to them. She said, "It's amazing. I thought it was just a problem with my husband. I'm always telling him, why don't you look at me when I'm talking to you?" And I said, no, this is a problem. If you think about it, if you look directly at a woman and talk to her, it could be seen as seductive. It could be seen as threatening to a boyfriend or a husband. If you look directly at a guy and talk to him, it could be seen as, you know, also threatening in a different kind of way. And men just don't necessarily look, and they talk ajar, and they do things side to side and so on rather than straight on. So it was interesting to tell her that, you know, it isn't just an odd fish you've got. This is something that you may run into if you hang around with men.
I think it's the origin of the bow, don't you think? The old, when you bow, I think it's like, it's a kind of, yeah. You're not, it's an act of anti-aggression.
I hadn't thought of that.
I really think it is.
It could be. Another example, a personal example. My wife was having all kinds of trouble with the head of the rhetoric program at Hamden City College. And for weeks and months, she would come home and complain about the things he'd done. And I'd listen to this, and I'd make suggestions, as men usually do, and I'd listen, and I'd listen. And then finally one night she said, "Steve, there's nothing anybody can do." And I said to her, "Why are we talking about it then? I mean, what in the world? We could be watching a movie. We could be having fun in all kinds of ways. Put it out of your mind. There's nothing you could do. And then I learned, actually, from this sex study, that women get something out of talking about things there's nothing they can do about it. I mean, it still seems to me absolutely bizarre that anybody would want to spend their time talking about something that has no solution. But lots of women do. And then I was able to see.
I'm bewildered by it too, brother.
Yeah, I could see that it wasn't just an odd woman I'd married. It seems to be a general problem. Yeah. Not the one I'm thinking of. But here's another angle that I also went further. And do you know that there's evidence, and you should know, that if a woman in a white-collar job doesn't get along with her boss, that her husband is more than three times more likely to die of a heart attack. Now, this comes out of Framingham Heart Study. This is as good a heart study as you're going to get through generations. Now, I didn't know that, but that puts another spin on it, doesn't it? Now, it's obvious why it's going on.
Because another man is giving her wife problems.
Exactly. Another man's picking on her wife. He feels like going out there. What can he do to his wife's boss? Absolutely nothing. Worse yet, he's got to listen to it every night. So when I read this study, I could understand, how this was could build up and lead to a heart attack. So maybe I would think women would want to know this. Maybe they'd only bring it up once a week. They don't want to kill their husbands. So I think you can learn something from it. Now, but here is a problem. If women bottle up problems they have with their husbands, they die more often. more quickly. But when God, they die more quickly, but the guys hate to hear criticisms, you know, whatever. They like to think they're trusted, they're a good husband. She realizes I'm a good husband, I'm a good father, I'm doing my best. And any little criticism, they don't want to hear it. And women have lists of criticism, of things that could be better. And all I can say is, how do you get around this? You know, there's lots of ways. Women can be very delicate if they want to. My wife is, you know, one morning she said, thanks so much for shaving today. I think you look great. Now, why did that come up? Because for a number of days, I hadn't shaved. Now, she could have said, why don't you shave? You know, at least I try to look good for you. At least you could, you know. Instead, she said, thank you so much for doing that. Well, I got the message. It wasn't nearly as difficult to deal with. And when I'm driving her somewhere, and she says, are you going to park over there on the right? Now, some women would say, you know, lots of spaces over here would be closer, you know. She doesn't say this. She says, are you going to park over the right? And it's always the best place to park. And I wasn't thinking about it. So, but then it's, yeah, sure, sure.
Right. Good decision.
Yeah. Good decision, yeah.
Yeah,
look, there's lots of women can do this. Don't bring up everything on a list. Get him when he's not tired. Talk about it quickly. Don't talk about how all the other things he's done wrong. You know, there's lots of ways to make this right. And I want to end by really reminding you of Jennifer Robach Morris, a wonderful statement. She has this glorious article that I can send to you if you want to ask me about it, about how she changed being the kind of woman she was. And lo and behold, her happiness, her marriage became much more happy. And she says, you know, I realized I had all these complaints, and I was always complaining, and it was about how he wouldn't do the important things on my list. He wouldn't do half of those important things on my list. And then I realized he's got a different list of important things to do. It never had occurred to me. He doesn't want to do half of everything on your list. He's got a different list about what the important things are to do. Now, that's an interesting insight, I think. And another insight is... you know, and it is true, you know, what do you do about the fact that you like a cleaner house than he does, which is what's typical? Now, if you say he should clean up half the time, well, in a way that's unfair. Lots of guys are really into their cars, but they don't ask you to come out and help them wax. You know, in some sense, if you care more about something, in a way it's fair for you to do more of it. But in a way, if he cares about you and knows how important it is to you, he should be cleaner than he used to be and do things because he loves you. So it's difficult, but you can see that there's more than one way to look at it. But I want to end by saying I begin my class on sex differences often with a poll in which I ask women, what do you like most about men? What do you dislike most about men? And men, what do you, same thing, what do you like most about women? What do you dislike most about women? Now, the first thing I would point out is they never say, oh, I don't know, I don't notice much difference. You know, men, women, they have no trouble coming to a conclusion.
They haven't read the Biblar Stacy study.
Yeah, right. But look, I really think it's interesting if you look at what they say, how what they don't like is often the flip side of what they do like, and how it's hard to imagine you're going to get the good things without the bad ones. Here's what the woman said they liked about men. Strong-willed. What they don't like, arrogant, macho. Well, you know, maybe he overdoes it some, but in control, strong. Well, you know, he can overdo that. Easygoing. On the other hand, never communicates his emotions. Well, you know, he's easygoing because he doesn't have as many emotions. You know, he doesn't get all upset about things and always all these highs and lows. So, you know, do you like it? Well, if you like it, maybe you won't get as much emotional discussion on the other side as you might like. And in control, but never admits he's wrong and so on. Sense of security and safety and protection, but he's arrogant. He's always sure he's right. You know, these things, it's hard to pull them off altogether. Now, what about men on women? Well, they say they're so sympathetic, they're caring, they're comforting, they have so much compassion. Well, what don't you like about them? They're so emotional. Well, you know, sympathy is an emotion. Compassion, you know, if you're compassionate and sympathetic, you're emotional. You're more emotional than people who are in control, you know, and easy to get along with and never get flustered. So I think it's important to look at at the good side more often than the bad side, that a lot of the things that you like in the opposite sex are somehow connected with the things you don't like. For example, I think women like a man who's, in some sense, he is a masculine man in the bedroom. He's a guy in the outside world that people pay attention to. But they'd like him to be an absolute egalitarian in every other part of the house. You know, it's kind of hard to pull off sometimes. You know, he's got a certain nature, and the things you admire, maybe a flip side, you don't always like them if they get out of hand. It's possible. It is possible to be a sensitive good guy in the rest of the house and still kind of in control in the bedroom. But it's not always comes easily, and I think to be more empathetic and more sympathetic and to try to look at the good side of what you're getting from this person who's not just like you is a recipe for good relationships and good marriages. Anyway, I think it's very impressive you all stayed so long and on a beautiful Saturday decided to devote your time to this, and quite impressive. I'm sure we all enjoyed it. So thank you for coming. Mm-hmm. Thank you.